ladies and gentlemen. Welcome, wrestling fans worldwide, to Knoxville and the Great Smoky Mountains for the Ron Fuller Tennessee Studcast.
6 feet 9 inches tall, 265 pounds.
This historic podcast from one of the most respected and successful wrestlers and promoters will follow the footsteps of one of the largest and oldest wrestling families on the planet.
The Tennessee Stud, Ron Fuller.
Through 93 years and four generations.
The Stud has arrived.
Old school or new fan, this unique broadcast will educate and captivate as Ron details decades of professional wrestling's growth with truly unforgettable stories.
I want those people out there at home to hear the Stud.
Sit back and enjoy the ride with the Tennessee Stud.
The Tennessee Stud. You will learn that name. You will remember it.
And now,
the Stud is here.
Please welcome the creator of the popular 605 podcast and the president of the Arcadian Vanguard Podcast Network, your co-host, the great Ryan Last.
Hello again, friends, and welcome back to another edition of Ron Fuller's Studcast. I am the great Ryan Last, and it's my pleasure to be with you once again as the Tennessee Stud takes us up and down that road of wrestling history, sharing his tales, many of them previously unknown, with all of us each and every week. Without any further ado, the man of the hour, the host of the Studcast, the legendary Tennessee Stud himself, Ron Fuller. Ron, how are you today?
I'm great, Brian. So glad to be here, my man. Got my old horse saddled up and ready to go and do another one. We've been pretty busy lately in the last few days, and episode 100 with Robert and Jimmy. Thank them very much for being a part of it. Had tremendous comments about that one. Everybody's loved it. So, yes, I'm ready to roll whenever you are, my man.
Well, we'll get rolling in just one moment, but want to make mention of what you just talked about. Thank you to everyone who has commented and listened and shared and downloaded episode 100 of the Studcast, a very special 90 minutes with Robert Fuller and Jimmy Golden live. It is a truly memorable podcast. We may have to do this again at some point down the road. But thank you to everyone. If you haven't heard it yet, check that out. And also, as of right now, the brand new Super Studcast number 18, part 2. The rest of the story with Ronnie Garvin is available for patrons of the Studcast. All you have to do is go to patreon.com/studcast or tnstud.com for only $2.99. You get in the door, and part 2 is one of the most memorable podcasts I've ever been a part of. We get to hear Ronnie talk all about the Knoxville Wrestling War from the all-star side of it. What were they saying in that apartment building? What were they whispering to each other? How did things get to the point they got to? Hear it from someone who was involved, who was one of the more critical people involved, one of the biggest stars in the history of Knoxville wrestling, Ronnie Garvin, on the latest Super Studcast, tnstud.com or patreon.com/studcast. More about that later in the show. But Ron, where are we going to today here on the Studcast?
Well, first, I took a second there to thank my brother and Jimmy. And today, I want to open up with a decision, WBIR, Knoxville's Channel 10 television station, concerning making Southeastern Wrestling Show a part of their programming. The answer, basically, to that proposal that I made in a couple of episodes back. Then when we return, I want to go to both sides of the state of Tennessee in the month of May. Going to talk some about Knoxville matches, Memphis matches, even an Arkansas match, as well as break down the Big Jim Hess TV of May 3rd, 1975. And toward the end of this one, hope we got the time for it, we're going to take a horrific and hysterical airplane flight, my first ever, with Ron and Don Wright. So this is a pretty full Studcast today, and really looking forward to it. And it's a great way to move past the 100th episode and toward, hopefully, the 200th episode, Brian. And I'm ready to roll whenever you are, my man.
I don't know if we'll get to 200 if there are too many episodes where we have to do flying with Ron and Don Wright. That may cause things to halt a little bit early in the process. But let's get going, Ron. I guess let's get back to the TV situation, because that's the one we've heard from so many listeners. They've been dying to know how this all gets resolved.
Okay, so let's begin with the critical answer from the largest TV station in Knoxville. And I'd made that proposal on Monday, April 28, 1975. The following day is the third Coliseum event. It's the day following that third Coliseum event. I get the call from them with their answer as promised. They said on that Monday that I made the proposal, they'd give me an answer on Friday, May 2nd. And the GM of the station made the call to me personally and welcomed me and my company, Southeastern Wrestling, to their station. It was one of the most important phone calls of my life. What was happening was even more critical than I realized. I was not aware what was going on at my present station. That's the station that Big Jim Hess is doing the program with. And it's going to be about 8 more days until I find out the answer to that question about what is going on over there. So I asked the WBIR GM when they wanted to begin the program on the air, and I was told that they wanted to start on Saturday, May 17, 1975. I asked what time slot we would be in on Saturdays. He said 2 p.m., which is the time I found to be ideal. I like that time. I had so much preparation to do, though. The thought of all of it just kind of terrified me. That's 15 days away from the day I get that telephone call. And I've got so much work to do to get this other program to look totally different than the one that I'm doing every Saturday on the channel of Sharp's Ridge. So let's talk a little bit about what happening in Southeastern Wrestling in Knoxville in May of 1975. In Studcast number 99, we finished with the third Coliseum event in which I won the world championship from Jack Briscoe for a total of about 1 minute, or until the number one hillbilly Ron Wright was able to jump into the ring and cost me the world championship. I'd knocked out Briscoe and hidden a weapon under my armpit while I didn't have a chance, because I didn't have a chance to hide it in my trunks. The referee had already raised my right hand, and he had, by doing that, had signified that I was the new champion of the world. And then he went to get the 10 pounds of gold to hand it to me, and I didn't see Ron Wright because I was so focused on the referee, because when he gives me that belt, to me, I'm officially the new world champion. The referee hands me the belt, and I reach for it with my right hand. I've still got that left hand clamped down, arm clamped down tight over that that gimmick I had underneath my arm. And as the referee handed me the belt in the right hand, Ron Wright's behind me, reaches and raises up my left hand at the same time, and my gimmick falls out on the mat right in front of the referee's eyes. So it's bye-bye world championship and back to a long-running program with Ron Wright, the man who had just cost me the NWA world title.
Ron, if we could take a step back, why did you think 2 p.m. was the ideal TV time slot to get?
Well, I mean, I kind of like that mid-afternoon time frame, especially in the wintertime. I think in the summertime, it probably not so well. I would say probably the absolute ideal time for a Saturday wrestling program is probably around 6 o'clock, 7 o'clock at night. I mean, you're not going to get into prime time, but very few times are you going to get that time slot offered to you. I was more concerned that he was going to potentially offer me a time slot at past 10:30 at night on a Saturday night. That would have been hard for me to be excited about, because you're going to lose a lot of the children audience and the teenage audience. There's a lot of reasons that that's not such a good time spot. But 2 o'clock in the afternoon worked just fine for me. I think we're going to have to compete with college football in football season. You're not going to get hurt by many other college type of events other than football. So I was kind of pleased with the 2 o'clock. It was something that might not have been my first choice, but it's something that I was happier to get than an opportunity at, say, a 10:30 p.m. time slot.
Let's get back to the wrestling shows in Knoxville that you're promoting. Obviously, the last one we really focused on was the Coliseum. You go back to Chilhowee Park after that, correct?
Yeah, you know, and I was going to bring it to your attention, you know, that once I do that, you've always asked me, you know, how do you follow those matches? And for the second time after the three Coliseum events, we're going to return to the park with a battle royal. And after the hot finish with Briscoe, I could have booked an obvious match with Ron Wright and I. But I decided to use the Battle Royal again, and not just have a Battle Royal, but maybe put more significance on my Southern Heavyweight Championship, and also do two things with this particular Battle Royal. I wanted to have the winner get a $5,000 check, obviously, and don't pay them in cash, but we always paid by check, and a title shot with me to build even more heat between me. Whoever wins the Battle Royal is going to get a title shot at me. And that kind of leaves me escaping wrestling Ron Wright right after this happens. And I think the fans wanted to see it as badly as anybody. And I thought that would put a little more heat on me by trying to escape that potential. So he'd been out and injured since the Texas Death Match, which was the main event in that second Coliseum show. The finish in the world title match with Briscoe set up perfectly for a return against Wright. And maybe that's a little bit of the reason why I didn't do it, because I always believed that great bookers were never predictable with their finishes, with their return matches, with their angles, or with their programs. I think when fans figure out where things are going, then bookers aren't doing their best work. I always thought that you outsmart and surprise the fans and you sell out your buildings. If you don't, you're not going to sell out your buildings on a regular basis. And that's what great bookers do, in my opinion. They outsmart the fans because every fan leaves that building thinking, oh, boy, they're going to do this next time. They're going to do that next time. And I think every time you can fool them and make it difficult for them to understand or get your technique or your strategy for booking, you're going to keep that job a heck of a lot longer.
Well, since you're talking about great bookers and what smart bookers do, what did you do? Were you a great booker and a smart booker? How did you recover? How did you build up to the next show coming out of that big Coliseum event?
Well, a thing that's really funny here, Brian, is, and I hadn't really realized it until I sat down and looked back at these, but we're in the process of running an unbelievable 3 shows in the same city in 7 days. We run the Friday before the Coliseum show on Sunday and come back and run the Friday following. That's 3 times we wrestled in Knoxville in a 7-day period of time. That's unheard of, and maybe probably a record for any city in the country. I don't know anybody's ever done that. I had almost outsmarted myself in the process because I didn't think about after that Coliseum show, I have no TV to promote the next Friday night. So I had to sit down and figure out at that time, what am I going to do here? How am I going to publicize this Friday night? So I didn't really realize it almost until I got to the Coliseum show that I don't have a Friday night here. So I figured out what I have to do is I had to advertise this show to the Coliseum crowd. And at the beginning of the Coliseum event and after each match, I had the announcer promote the 15-man Battle Royal next Friday night at Chilhowee Park. I had him also announce that the winner of the Battle Royal is going to get 2 things. They're going to get a $5,000 check for winning the Battle Royal and a Southern title championship match with Ron Fuller the week after that. So then to get the most out of this announcement, I had every guy who was on the Coliseum show and in Knoxville the next Friday night and going to be a part of that Battle Royal to make a comment in the ring before their match as the night went on in the Coliseum or as the afternoon because we were running at 3:00. So that meant that I sent to the ring Sam Bass. He's going to speak on behalf of Ron and Don Bass, who are in that Battle Royal the next Friday night. Tojo Yamamoto is going to have a chance to say what he wants to about the Battle Royal the next Friday night. Jerry Jarrett, Jimmy Golden, Les Thatcher, and Ron Wright, all of them are going to have an opportunity because they're all going to wrestle on that Coliseum card. And before their match starts, they're going to go to the ring first, and they're going to plug the Battle Royal for the next Friday night. It worked great because we were promoting to our largest crowd ever at this point. That Coliseum show was, again, the biggest Coliseum show yet. And if we weren't promoting not one future event, but we're promoting 2 Friday nights when we promote the one. So I was, in essence, encouraging those new fans in attendance at the Coliseum that liked the Coliseum and had never been to the park to go to the park, whether they liked it or not. So, you know, I'm kind of driving business toward the park because I'm not going to be in the Coliseum every week. Don't have strong enough crowds yet to be able to do that. But I do want them to come to the park and follow the program, get to, interested in the wrestlers and interested in the angles and what we're doing. And we're going to get them someday into a situation where we got enough audience, we can be in that Coliseum all the time.
So that's what you did throughout the night to promote the upcoming Friday night show at Chilhowee Park. What did you actually do on the show in the main event? You against Jack Briscoe for the NWA world title.
Well, when it came time for the world title match, I went to the ring first, just like everybody else that had that is going to be in that battle royal on the following Friday night. And I basically did an interview before Jack even came out about the battle royal the next Friday night, and also complained about having to defend my title against the winner of the battle royal on the following Friday night. I got real great heat when I reminded the fans that after I win tonight, none of it's going to make any difference because I will be defending the world title next Friday night in some wonderful city and not here in hillbilly heaven of Knoxville. And, you know, got a real boo there, you know. And then I continued by saying, if I lose tonight and I am in the battle royal next Friday and I'm going to win it, I'll get the 5,000, and then there I have nobody to contend with on the next Friday night because I won't have to defend my title. So it was kind of an unusual way to begin a world title match and at the same time to promote the next 2 weeks' matches. But turned out to be great. We end up going back on that Friday night and doing pretty darn well.
What was the rest of the card for that Friday night?
It's 5 days after the Coliseum show. It's a 15-man battle royal with 5,000 prize and the shot at me the following Friday night for the Southern Championship. And also on that card were the Tennessee Tag Champions, Ron and Don Bass, managed by their manager, Sam, defending against their championship, the Tennessee Championship, against Ron and Don Wright. Jimmy Golden versus Crazy Luke Graham. Dennis Condrey wrestling me. Jerry Jarrett and Tojo Yamamoto versus the British Butcher and Al Green, and Les Thatcher against Tony Costello. That Friday night card, I got involved in the match between the Brass Brothers and the Wright Brothers for the Bass's Tennessee Tag Championship, and that caused the Wrights to lose. But Ron Wright came back in the Battle Royal, and it ends up me and him as the final two guys in that Battle Royal. And so he manages to toss me out of the battle royal, and he's going to get that Southern Championship match the following Friday night. Jimmy Golden, may I just go ahead and give you the results of every one of those matches that night. Obviously, the Wright boys lost to the Bass boys. Jimmy Golden beat Luke Graham. I beat Dennis Condrey. Jerry Jarrett and Tojo Yamamoto beat the British Butcher and Al Green, and Les Thatcher won over Tony Costello. So, we're set up pretty well, had a decent crowd. We're outside still, decent weather. We did not get rained out for this one or where we would have had to move into the smaller building. And we probably did about close to 3,000 fans out there, considering wow. That was the third night in 7 days that they'd had wrestling in Knoxville. Pretty amazing, actually.
I've asked you before, how do you follow up the big Coliseum event, especially in this case where you have three shows within 7 days? How do you follow it up on TV when you've now had two arena shows, including a major one, since your last TV?
Well, the next day, on May 3rd, that is your TV day. And Big Jim Hess, I'm going to give Big Jim Hess a happy day. I threw Hess a real bone to chew on because I felt sorry for him since I got that good news from Channel 10 that I'm going to be moving. But I sure didn't tell Big Jim about this move. I said nothing to anybody, actually, about it. And after the Battle Royal win the night before, I have Ron Wright join Big Jim at the desk, and he's going to show the film of the world title match with Briscoe and how he single-handedly kept me from winning the world championship. And obviously, he and Big Jim had a ball with that segment right there, and the crowd was thoroughly enjoying it as well. And And then he continued to party after he finished showing how Wright had cost me the world championship with the film of Ron Wright beating me in the battle royal and actually throwing me over the top rope, and how he's going to have the championship match the following week with me. So that's what Ron is talking about in this segment, is about the now having a shot at my Southern title again. And he has won that title one time before, so he's calling it his belt, and he wants to get his belt back. And as if that wasn't enough, O'Ron goes and gets $5,000 in $100 bills and brings it to the TV and spends the entire interview flashing around the big handful of $100 bills to prove he'd won the battle royal. And he just kept talking about the next Friday night and how he was going to put that old Tennessee dog whooping on Ron Fuller and take my Southern title from him in Chilhowee Park. Then to really make Big Jim's day, before I took the legs out from under him the following Saturday, that's exactly what I'm going to do, I joined Hess at the desk for my segment. I had an entire segment with him, and I started off my segment by bitching about why I didn't get a chance to show and tell my side of the world title match. Why would they give Ron Wright that opportunity? I'm knocking the promotion. Certainly don't want them to know I am the promoter. So it's a good reason for me to say, this isn't fair. You know, I should have been the guy watching the world title match and explaining what he did wrong, instead of me having to sit back in the dressing room and watch it on a monitor about how he cost me the world title match. And Ron Wright wasn't involved in the match. He had no business watching the match and talking over the match. He had no business getting involved in the damn match. So that's how I kind of started. And then I started into how horrible it was to be handed the world championship belt after beating the champion fair and square in the middle of the ring, and then have a stupid hillbilly take it from me that way. Raise my arm and my gimmick falls out. I mean, it's just horrible. So, and you can imagine how much Big Jim's loving this segment. And, that made it even better for him that I got on there and I'm all pissed off about it. And I've got all these reasons. And, after I have my say, and I was extremely frustrated with having to now defend my Southern title against the hillbilly the next Friday night, Hess introduces another film. And what they did is I had them film my short interview right before the match with Jack Briscoe. So when it introduces this one and it shows me bragging about the fact that I'm not going to be in Knoxville next week because I'm going to be the world champion and I'm going to be wrestling in a real city instead of hillbilly heaven. I mean, it worked perfect. The studio crowd just went crazy when they saw it. And they were loving my embarrassment. You know, my face was probably red, almost as much. They enjoyed it almost as much as Big Jim did. I mean, he really, really had some big laughs in this entire segment. And I was sure after these two segments that if it didn't rain and force us indoors on the next Friday night, that'd be May the 9th, that we were going to put a big crowd in Chilhowee Park Amphitheater. Then he announced the entire card for that Friday night, May the 9th, while I sat there, and he kept putting this special significance on the main event where I was going to defend my Southern title against the winner of the Battle Royal and the $5,000, Ron Wright. He just kept heaping it on. And at this point, I'm loving the fact he's heaping it on because the fans are loving it. It's getting me more heat than I ever expected out of this segment. And let's just go through the rest of the card from May the 9th at Chilhowee Park. Also on that same card is the Tennessee Tag Champions, Ron and Don, with Sam Bass, defending their belts against Jimmy Golden and Jerry Jarrett. And Tojo Yamamoto is going to wrestle Phil Hickerson. Don Wright wrestle Al Green. And there's another ladies match on that card with Sylvia Hackney against Mae Goodner and Jerry Bryant against Sam Bass. So, we got a loaded card for the 9th. We've had two great segments on that television program. I'm looking for some good results out of that ninth card, provided we don't have rain.
Well, here are the results as listed in the newspaper. Title bout is draw. Ron Fuller still holds the Southern Heavyweight Wrestling Championship. His title bout with Ron Wright Friday night at Chilhowie Park ended in a draw, the result of a double disqualification. Ron and Don Bass, managed by Sam Bass, scored a tag victory over Jerry Jarrett and Jimmy Golden. Tojo Yamamoto and Phil Hickerson fought to a draw. Don Wright triumphed over Tony Costello. Sylvia Hackney defeated May Goodner, and Jerry Bryant won via disqualification over Sam Bass. So those are the results to that show, Ron.
All right. And luckily, the weather was good. And we did well over 3,000 fans. It was really, I felt good about where we were headed. We'd have been close to 4,000 in the Coliseum. Now we're doing 3,000 in Chilhowie Park. I felt like maybe we had gotten some of those Coliseum fans to come to Chilhowie Park and to spend their money there. And that made me feel real, real good about the future and where we were headed.
Ron, I think this is a good place to take our break. When we return, we will talk a little bit more about Big Jim Hess and this TV situation, as well as the TV show from May 10th, 1975. We're also going to fly to West Tennessee in just a moment. But first, listen to this word about Super Studcast number 18 with Ronnie Garvin.
Never in Super Studcast history has a part two rest of the story been more anticipated than with the new Super Studcast number 18 with Ronnie Garvin. It is now available at tnstud.com or patreon.com/studcast. Fans were blown away with part one, but part two is the most comprehensive discussion of the Knoxville War of 1979 ever. Kudos to the Tennessee Stud for bringing one of the Knoxville Five live on this podcast and breaking down this destructive event from both sides of the story. Hear for yourself how things got out of hand and where mistakes were made that led to the shocking Plan B video released to the public 40 years later. This story is true wrestling history of one of its most disastrous wars that led to the crash of the best little NWA territory on the planet. At tnstud.com or patreon.com/studcast. Only $2.99 for that three unforgettable hours. Saddle up for something truly super.
There you hear it, Super Studcast number 18, part 2 with Ronnie Garvin. Dare I say, it may be the most memorable Super Studcast we've ever done. We've done so many classic ones, so many memorable ones, but this one really sheds a new light on wrestling history. We finally get to hear the leader of Southeastern Wrestling speak to the biggest star who went with All-Star Wrestling against Southeastern Wrestling, Ron Fuller and Ronnie Garvin, talking all about the 1979 Knoxville Wrestling War. You need to hear this if you love wrestling history. Go to patreon.com/studcast or tnstud.com. $2.99 gets you in the door, and you get access to some other really, really tremendous studcasts. But we'll have more information about that at the end of the program. Ron, I mentioned that we're going to talk a little bit more about the TV situation. I guess let's start there.
Okay. But when we're going to leave, we wrestled on Friday night, May the 9th. We've had over 3,000 people. And I show up the TV on Saturday morning, May the 10th, 1975. Drive up to the top of Sharp's Ridge. It's one of the highest points in downtown Knoxville area. To the WTVK television station there. And it is the station I have been on since buying Knoxville from John Cassan almost 6 months earlier. This day is going to be like no other in my wrestling, promoting, and ownership career. It's going to be really, really an unusual day. It will be my last TV show produced and shown from the WTVA TVK television station. And I had told no one about the new TV station move since I found out 8 days earlier, except Les Thatcher. I wanted no one to even know I had made a proposal to move stations in case I was turned down. I knew Big Jim had been exerting his negative opinion on the management of the Sharp Ridge station. I did not know how big Jim's opinion was being taken, but I did know if they found out I had gone to a competing station to get a slot there, it would surely be the end for me on their station. I felt bad about changing stations in a secret manner. And, it was kind of a secret, obviously, and the reason for it, I'm sure everybody understands at this point. And I felt bad about it, but I knew the consequences if I failed. If by some chance they were going to cancel my show based upon Big Jim's feelings, I had no choice but to secretly try to move to protect my own company and maybe my own future. I had thankfully been accepted on WBIR-TV, and all I needed to do that day, other than the show, was inform the management and my renegade commentator that this was their last wrestling show there. I have to admit, there's a great deal of dread and coming up to that day. You know, I kind of dreaded going in there and having to talk to a GM about the fact that, you know, I'm leaving you. No notice, basically. Very, very short notice. 1 week notice. That's kind of crazy. And I'd only talked to this station GM once before, when John Kazana took me there to introduce me when I was thinking about buying the company from him. So I knew that GM occasionally came in on Saturdays because I'd seen him there a time or two. But I still wasn't eager to see him that day, but I knew I had to see him that day. So I wasn't looking forward to it, but facing him because I felt like in a way I was sneaking out the back door. And all that apprehension turns out to be wasted as soon as I walk in the door.
Ron, let me ask you real quick before you continue with this story. You have the agreement in place to start a week later on WBIR. Did you actually have a contract in place?
No, I never signed a contract with WBIR.
Never here in the initial weeks and months, or never in the entire time you were on?
Never in the entire time I did business with them. And John Kazana had no contract with WTVK when I bought the business from him. Sometimes with a lot of stations, I dealt with so many television stations in the years following this first visit and getting on WBIR, and I never asked for a contract. And I asked my dad, it was the question that I had asked my dad and Eddie Graham when I started thinking about what I'm going to do in this proposal to get on the other station. I asked them about contracts. I said, do you have contracts with your television stations? And they have no contracts. I don't know if it was the fact that promoters were so happy to get on that they didn't want to rock the boat too much for a while. They wanted to prove that they were going to be able to do a good job there and to get good ratings. And when you do that, they don't have much reason to let you go at that point. So, you know, I didn't want to rock the boat. I didn't want to push it with this GM when I had that meeting, when I did the proposal. You know, once he talked to me about, yes, we want you on our station, I was really glad to hear that. I felt like that I might be overstepping my bounds to ask for a contract, because obviously in the wrestling business, contracts with your television stations was not something back in those days that you did. And I think, Brian, that's probably because everybody's ratings were so good. Wrestling was such a great product that TV stations were all looking for wrestling. And when you went into a market, for instance, I have to get a TV in Mobile when I go down and buy that Gulf Coast territory from Lee Fields. They're not even on TV in Mobile, and I buy the territory without them having television in Mobile because I feel confident that I can get on just about any station I want to, because I have a good pitch and I have a good product. Once we start doing that Southeastern show on WBIR, I have 50 tapes that I could feel comfortable to just take one off the rack and not have to worry about what the content was, that if I showed it to somebody, they would be like, wow, I've never seen a wrestling program like that. So, you know, I felt like it wasn't necessary, but that's a darn good question. And I know darn well that Vince has signed a whole lot of papers, no doubt.
Yeah.
with his companies nowadays. It's a different animal anymore than what it used to be back in those days.
Well, one last question before we move on with this, Ron. I want you to get back to the story because you kind of left it with a cliffhanger that you had all this apprehension that was wasted when you got there. I want to hear where you're going with that. But on this topic, one last thing. You don't have a contract. You're starting in a week. You don't let too many people know what you're doing. Do you go over there at any point with a production guy and try to get the specs? Try to figure out how you actually are going to shoot wrestling in that TV studio? Are you going to fit a ring in that studio? Do you do any of that prep work already, or do you wait until after you inform WTVK that you're leaving?
No. The day I got the call on May 2nd from the GM, I went there the following Monday. I started doing my homework immediately because I knew I was going. There was no doubt about that. And I wanted to see the studio. I wanted to have a really nice set. And everything seems to work out right. And that's kind of what we're going to do with our next week's program is we're going to really dig into deep of what I had to do to get prepared over there at Channel 10 because, yeah, there's a tremendous amount of work to be done. And the television station itself takes it upon themselves to bring me in there. We cut a spot. I say don't let this be seen, but we cut a spot with me on it about coming on that channel, and they start running that spot immediately after I notify TVK. So on that same Saturday, when I'm about to have this conversation with the GM at TVK, they're already starting to run at 6:30 that night when this TVK show airs. They're going to start running after this show that wrestling's coming to their channel. I'm prepared for it.
So you were dreading this meeting with the general manager at TVK. You said that all the apprehension was wasted. What happened?
Well, oddly enough, I was just shocked as I could be because I come in the front door in the reception area downstairs, and I'm immediately stopped by a girl that's working at the reception desk. She's there every week. I see her every week when I go in there. And she stops me and she says, Ron, the GM, I can't remember his name, would like to see you this morning. And so she gets up and she leads me to his office. He's upstairs. And as you might imagine, my mind's kind of racing now, like, gosh, what the heck, man? This is pretty unusual. I was about to ask for him, and now he's asked for me. So trying to figure out what the heck is going on. I'm more than happy to make the trip up there because I know what I've got to do. She knocks on the door, and he asks to come in, and I go on in. She doesn't even come in the room. He's very cordial and polite. Asked me to have a seat in front of him at his desk. And I wanted to tell him right away about my move to the other station, but I think he was even more nervous than I was. I was really nervous about this, and he seemed to be, gosh, he just took the wheel, so to speak, and he started quickly and just went right to the point. You know, and as best I can remember, he said, I needed to talk to you this morning because I have bad news for you. He got right to the point. He didn't beat around the bush. He says something like to the effect, I know you haven't been here a long time, but we're not happy with the results of our wrestling program's ratings since you have arrived. Now, that's only 6 months earlier. So the recent February book, he blames this on the recent February book, showed that your program's rating have been stagnant since your arrival. And I'm sorry to be the one to have to deliver you the news, but your show has been terminated by the decision of several of our top management employees and obviously me as the GM. That excuse didn't carry much water with me, and I would have been totally decimated. I just can't imagine how that would have killed me if I hadn't have already done what I did and gone to the other station. So I'd have been out of business, and the other station's answer would have been no to me moving there. I would have been done. My wrestling ownership of a company would have basically been worthless at this point because there's only one of those television stations in town, and my chances of getting on there are probably not good if the other two don't want me. So I don't feel I'm not there. I don't care about making him feel comfortable at this point. So I just go ahead and make him uncomfortable. So I smiled and I asked him, do you think that with only 2 months time, I could have made a significant difference in the numbers of people that watch your program? And do you think that was giving me enough time to take one of the worst wrestling shows in the country and turn it around? You know, and I don't think he expected me to come back with anything. You know, he kind of stammered, and that gave me opportunity to go on. So I said, I asked him more questions. Do you have any idea what a quality wrestling show even looks like? And then I couldn't resist, man, getting in a little parting shot. So I said, do you have any idea what a joke your commentator that I inherited from John Kazana would be like in any other city in the world? He had nothing to say. I mean, it's like now he was just quiet, kind of leaned back in his chair. He's speechless. I don't think he was expecting any argument, like I said. And luckily, I didn't need to try and save the show. I just wanted to let him know that, you know, saying that it's because of this February book is absolutely ridiculous, because the book doesn't get taken. The numbers are collected in January, and I only arrived there in November. So, you know, for me to be able to change the numbers, and it would have been impossible for anybody to do that. So I started to respond, and I stood up. I reached over the desk. I shook his hand and said, it's been nice doing business with you. And then I hit him with one last shot, too. I said, I hope you keep looking at those rating books that you based your decision on, because you're going to see some huge numbers from wrestling there in the future. But it isn't going to be on this station, you know. And I'm sure when I left there, he probably had to think about that for a little bit. What does he mean by that?
What did you think the real reason was? Because obviously you don't believe it's about the ratings books. Do you think it was Big Jim Hess? Do you think they found that you were talking to BIR? Why do you think they canceled wrestling that morning?
I believe it's Big Jim Hess. And, I kind of got a little bit of a proof for it in a way. So I leave his office and I go downstairs to the studio for the first time that day. And I see people going, cameramen, all those people. I say hello like normal, but I don't mention any of this to anyone, not what I've just encountered upstairs with the GM. I just went about my business as if nothing had happened. I took the format and handed it to Big Jim, but I couldn't help but notice he was looking at me very strangely. That really was a little bit of an answer for me right there. You know, he was kind of eyeing me like, well, I figured he's going to be really down. He probably, it gave me a feeling that he maybe knew. Obviously, I had thoughts about whether he knew or not about what had just happened. So I think he'd even asked me once, was something wrong? Ron, is something wrong? You know, I think he wanted me to tell him, you know. And I gave him no indication anything was wrong, because I knew if I did, he was probably going to really submarine me on that show that day. I needed one more decent show out of him, and this was the last show, and this was the last day, and I was determined to get it that day. I wanted to get one more decent show out of him. I was going to have my say, but I wanted to wait until the show was over to get my say. And that kind of brings me to a point here. You know, I was going to wait until I want to wait until next week to finish the Big Jim Hess situation, because I want to do a special show next week on Knoxville TV shows and stations, and all about ending the old program and beginning the new. And it'll kind of answer something like you've asked earlier about, you know, what did I do to prepare? You know, rather than to go back and go through what I'm going to tell Big Jim Hess, next week I want to do the entire program on ending one show and beginning another. And Right now, I'd like to go to the west side of the state, Brian, and talk about what's going on over there in Memphis and even in Arkansas, because that's where their television goes. And I've got a great Ron Wright story that I'm saving for the end of the day's program.
All right, so let's get going. I guess you were wrestling Jack Briscoe in Knoxville for your company, Southeastern. Same period of time you're wrestling him in Memphis for Jerry Jarrett.
Yes, and I just finished wrestling him twice in Memphis on April 14th and again 2 weeks later on April 28th. Both of those nights were total sellouts of more than 11,300. The second one on April 28th had the best first ever. It was the first time they had ever raised ticket prices for a world championship, and that house produced the all-time box office record for that time period by 11,300. I think they raised the prices $1 per ticket. That raised, obviously, $11,000 worth more income from that particular show. My father and my brother had been battling the three Australians in the early part of April with no help from me because I was a heel and I wanted to remain a heel until the night of April 14th. And that's when I faced Jack Briscoe for the first time for the world title. I'd already described in earlier studcast how I went instantly from a top heel to a top babyface by helping my father and brother on that night. The next Monday, April 21st, Rob and I had our first tag match in Memphis, Mid-South Coliseum, against the Aussies. On Monday, April 28th, I had that second shot at Jack Briscoe that I mentioned earlier, and Rob and Jimmy were in the semifinals that night against the Aussies. So as we moved into May of 1975, on May the 5th, Rob and I faced the Aussies for their Southern Tag titles in Memphis. It was another crowd above 10,000. That night, we experienced a pretty brutal beating when the third Aussie, Johnny Gray, came down to the ring and really got involved in the match. Didn't ever left the ring once he got involved and in the ring. And it left two of us facing the three Aussies. And we were both bleeding and fighting pretty horribly in that match. And then the next Monday night, my dad comes and joins us in a six-man tag event. And it was another sellout that night when we did the six-man of over 11,000. And on that same card, Ron and Don Wright, this is May the 12th. On that same card, Ron and Don Wright are going to wrestle against Eddie Marlin and Tojo Yamamoto. And that's kind of where I'm getting to a story here about old Ron Wright and Don Wright and flying over there to Memphis, because this is the first time that the two of them have been on that Memphis card. Now, Jerry Jarrett and I have been exchanging talent for a considerable length of time now. He has been using some of my guys. He used Dale Lewis. He used Dutch Mantell and John Foley some. Now he's using Ron Don Wright, who had been to Memphis before, but it had been many, many years since they had been. So they're going over there, and they invite me to take a plane ride with them. As we continue into May of 75 in Memphis, on May the 19th, I successfully defend my Southern title against the head Aussie, George Barnes, and my brother and father. We're going to go a little further into May here. I'm wrestling George Barnes for my Southern title, and Rob and my dad are going to wrestle Bill Dundee and his other Aussie, Johnny Gray. And this was another crowd over 10,000. So I got to looking back at some numbers that really, really shocked me, were truly amazing to me. It was a record 9 straight weeks in the Memphis Mid-South Coliseum in the months of April and May, late March, all of April and into early May, in which the Coliseum drew 10,000 plus fans per event. And I'm not sure, but this too may be an all-time record. That's truly amazing. That building held 11,300 in 9 straight weeks. It averaged over 10,000 for every event.
You said you also wrestled in Arkansas during this period of time. Where'd you wrestle?
Well, actually, the next night, I wrestled in a spot show, a little small town for Jarrett over in Arkansas in the city of Blytheville. And it's one of those rare appearances that I ever made in Arkansas. In fact, I only wrestled twice in Arkansas my entire career. And Blytheville happens to be the town that I wrestled my very first match with my dad against Don Carson and Dick Dunn in 1968. I'm truly amazing. I go back to Blytheville all those years later to wrestle in the main event there. And the match that night in Blytheville was an extremely unusual one. I worked with Norvell Austin, who was, in my opinion, one of the greatest black wrestlers of that time and a future star for Southeastern and Knoxville. He's going to come to Knoxville and get over great. I put up my Southern title against him, and I had to beat him. These were extremely crazy rules, but I had to beat him three times in less than 30 minutes, or I had to forfeit and give him the title. What a match we had. It was amazing to me. When I really got the looking at how they had booked this, how Jared had booked this, it was like, how the hell do you beat a guy three times in 30 minutes? And if you don't beat him, he ends up with your belt. So it was really good. The match was fantastic. We won the third fall against him with only 30 seconds remaining in that 30-minute match. That crowd was going crazy, and he was about to beat me and about to beat me and about to beat me. And I small package him with 30 seconds left, and he gets himself counted out. I'd never been in that type of match before. I was extremely surprised to see the excitement in the crowd, especially as we approached that 30-minute mark. And it was a good example of the creativity of a young Jerry Jarrett as a booker. It's a great little match. It's a super idea for a way to book a match. The building there, by the way, was full 30 minutes before bell time. And I was told by many people there that night that the building, they turned away more people than they could have put inside the building. So wrestling was an extremely hot commodity in the West Tennessee area during this time frame.
It was also a hot commodity in East Tennessee, and that's where you and Ron and Don Wright were coming from. What's this story about this flight, Ron?
Okay. Yeah, so this is a story I really love. So Ron knows 2 weeks out that he's booked over there with Don. And he starts, and he knows that I'm flying every night on Mondays over to wrestle in Memphis. I stay over and that I fly back, that I fly on commercial flights, obviously. And he says, he asked me about, hey, Ron, we're going to be over there on that night on Monday. And how about flying with me? We're wrestling against Eddie Marlin and Tojo Yamamoto. First time he asked me, I said, no, Ron, I don't think so, man. I want to take the commercial flight. And then he kept harping on the fact that, Ron, if you fly with us, we're going to fly back home because we got to work the next day and you'll get back home. You won't have to spend the night in Memphis. He kept on and kept on. Finally, I agreed to it. I was obviously hesitant about it, once he says, hey, you can be home on Monday night rather than staying in Memphis, I finally says, okay, let's do it, Ron. So I informed Jared that you don't have to buy me a ticket for this Monday, May 5th show, because I'm going to fly over with Ron Don. But I did not check the weather that morning when I got up on that Monday morning. And that was probably my first mistake, because there's a cold front moving east across Arkansas that stretched about 500 miles to the north. And a commercial jet, if I'd have gotten on the jet like at 1 o'clock in the afternoon, the flights that I was usually taking over to Memphis, it would have gone right over that front without having a problem. But Ron Wright's little twin engine Cessna is a whole different story. So the Wrights landed at the airport to pick me up about 4 o'clock in the afternoon. And the skies are just starting to cloud up a little bit over there where I am. That means the front is somewhere between Knoxville and Memphis about the time that we're taking off. So we lake off and Ron wants me to have a seat in the co-pilot seat. And I say, no, Ron, I believe I'm going to take a seat in the back, two seats back there. Four seats on a plane, twin engine plane, small Cessna. And I hope everybody bears in mind that I have probably been on 100 flights in small planes at this point, many of them with Lester Welch, my dad's uncle, who was a tremendous pilot. And Ron doesn't even have an instrument rating at this point. So it's pretty dangerous to be in the air with someone, especially with the weather that's between where we are and where we're going. And I probably would not have taken that flight. I might not even have gone at all had I had any idea what was ahead of us. So what I do is I get on the plane and we take off and we start flying across the state toward Memphis. Whether you can see the weather on the horizon when you get up to about 12, 15,000 feet in altitude, I can see the black all along the horizon as far as you can see. And I know, been in planes long enough to know what that is. And so I asked Ron, I said, Ron, is that a front up there? And he goes, yeah, I believe it is, Ron. You know, I said, you don't know about it? He goes, no, I didn't know. Weather been pretty, it was a pretty day. I didn't check. I was like, boy, I'm thinking right then, wow, man, this is not good. So we continue to fly. You know, I'm like, well, you know, Ron, we can't fly over that front. Well, yeah, Ron, we'll make it. It won't be too bad. He was just trying to make me feel better. But as we fly closer to the front, plane starts to, it starts to darken up. Clouds start to reach us, and the plane's just rocking and rolling. It's like, wow, it's bad. And then he starts to, I notice he changes his direction and he flies south. He starts to go south because I think he's trying to get to the southern end of the front, hopefully. So anyway, it's bouncing like crazy and he finally gets scared. I can hear a little bit in his voice and he says, Donnie, he goes, Donnie, you get that book right there. We got to find our airport. We got to put her down. You know, and I'm glad to hear that because I wanted him to put it down. I knew we were not going to fly through this front. Donnie's over there thumbing through the book and Ron's fighting that steering wheel up there. And I'm bouncing around in the back and I'm just going, gosh, Ron, what are you doing here? And then we finally get into an area where there's the Tri-Cities. There's a little city there, Muscle Shoals, Florence, and Sheffield, Alabama, in the northwestern corner of the state of Alabama. And they find us a place to get into Florence Airport. And we land in Florence, Alabama, and we get off the plane. And now the front it's basically arrived. It's there. It's really rocking and rolling. It's so bad we get between the little tiny airport for small planes. We go in there. We're soaking wet just from the plane to get into there. And we sit there for a few minutes and I start looking at the watch and I say, guys, we're not going to be able to fly out of here. We maybe can rent a car and drive from here it's probably 125 miles from there to Memphis. So maybe we can drive and get there by 8 o'clock and be able to still go ahead and work. So they say, Ron's mad about it. No, I want to fly, but he can't fly. You know, it's just too bad. So we get into a car. We go over the main terminal, and there's a little rental car there. We rent a car. We get in the car, and we start driving west toward Memphis. We get about 15 minutes out of the airport, and it's still cloudy and raining, but up to the front of us is a little hole in that front in a cloud. You can see a little blue through there. And Ron goes to Don. He goes, Donnie, he goes, you see that blue through the clouds there? He says, that could be the end of the front. And I wait. And he goes, we can turn around. We'll go back and get the plane. And I said, no, guys. I'm like, no, we don't want to go back and get the plane, please. Oh, yeah, well, I think we can, Ron. We'll be able to fly through that hole. I said, that hole won't be there, Ron, when we get back to the airport. We're not going to be able to fly through a hole that's not going to be there. Yeah, we're going to go. So they turn the car around. We go back. We get on the plane, and it is still storming. We've taxi out to the end of the runway, and there's no activity at the airport. Nobody's flying in nor out. It's still bad. And we get to the end of the runway, and he turns around to where we want to go. And sure enough, the little hole, seeing this, comes right across the end of the runway like it was right there meant for us. And he calls the tower. And I'll never forget, he goes, hey, this is a Cessna such a 1247 whatever requesting to take off. And the guy in the tower goes, are you nuts? That's what I'm thinking in the back seat. Are you crazy, Ron? Yeah, I wanted to go, yeah, we're nuts. You know, but Ron says, no, he goes to the guy in the tower. He says, look down there to the left. He goes, you see that hole in that cloud? And the guy at the tower says, yeah, so what? And he goes, I'm going to fly right through that hole. And the guy in the tower goes, well, boys, he goes, it's your ass. You have my permission to take off. Oh, and I'm sitting back there going, no, Ron, no, let's don't take off. And here we go. He cranks her up, man, and when we take off, we go right through that little hole. As soon as we pass through the hole, there's nothing but blue sky all the way to Memphis. It was the end of the front. So we fly on to Memphis and wrestle that night. By the time we turn around after the match is over and go back and get on the plane, the front is cleared Knoxville, and we fly back without any problems whatsoever. But it was the only time I ever remember flying through a hole in the cloud and passing right straight through the middle of a front. And there's a lot more for people that are interested in these Ron Wright plane stories. Super Stud Cast number 2. It's all about Ron Wright, and there are all kinds of plane stories. We're going to get to all of them in a regular stud cast, but if somebody wants to just have a colossal, small plane, disastrous podcast, there it is for you, Super Stud Cast number 2 with Ron Wright.
Well, that's a good place to end this stud cast episode, Ron, and as we do, we want to remind everyone, you can become friends with Ron on Facebook, the page Ron Fuller, the Tennessee Stud. You can follow the Stud on Instagram and Twitter at Ron Fuller Welch. You can follow me on Twitter at Great Brian Last. You can follow the Arcadian Vanguard Podcast Network on Twitter at Super Podcasts. And you can hear me on the 605 Super Podcast at 605pod.com or available wherever it is that you find your favorite podcast for classic wrestling talk and wrestling humor. The 605 Super Podcast. I want to again remind you not to miss the latest Super Studcast, Super Studcast number 18, part 2 with Ronnie Garvin. It's the rest of the story with Ronnie Garvin, all about the Knoxville Wrestling War from 1979. For the first time ever, two guys from the two different sides in the war on the line at the same time, the Tennessee Stud Ron Fuller and the one-man gang Ronnie Garvin. Hear it today at tnstud.com or patreon.com/studcast. Only $2.99 a month gets you in the door. Ron, where are we going next week?
Well, Brian, I know last week we had a special episode number 100, but next week's show is going to be a special one for me, too, and I think it will be for fans, too. Also, we're going to dive into television wrestling shows, especially the Knoxville ones. We're finally going to say goodbye to Big Jim Hess and the old show of John Kazana, and we're going to begin a whole new era in Knoxville television wrestling, as well as studio wrestling shows around the world, because we're going to be copied all over the world with what we're going to start doing with that new Knoxville television program. For all historical fans, this will be pure gold, because this is pure wrestling history at its finest. We're going to leave the worst wrestling show in America to produce the best wrestling show in America.
Ron Fuller's Studcast is a production of the Arcadian Vanguard Podcast Network. For the Tennessee Stud Ron Fuller, I'm the Great Brian Last. The story continues next week.
Thanks for joining us today for this historic Studcast. The true story continues next week. So full Nelson your friends and point them in our direction for another ride with the Tennessee Stud.
One, two, three.
This is David Summers saying so long from the Great Smoky Mountains.